You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. It's the early 1920s, and the sleepy village of Burton Dasset in Warwickshire becomes the epicentre of a series of strange encounters. The locals begin to see strange lights in the sky that seem to be acting intelligently, or even, some would say, mischievously. Former policeman and now author Richard Rogerby takes us on a trip back 100 years into the past to try and uncover just what were the lights upon the hills. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. A big thank you to my latest patrons, Dave, Emma, and Samuel. Thank you for joining the team. And to each and every one of my patrons who have supported me over the last 12 months, thank you. Your support is greatly appreciated. You can also click the link in the show notes to sign up as well. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find us at mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Our intro and outro music are performed by the fabulous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is of course produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. 2024 is upon us, as we look to both the skies and the past of Burton Dasset to ponder, what were the lights upon the hills? A 100 years ago, a strange incident occurred over the medieval village of Burton Dasset in Warwickshire that left the locals perplexed. In his newly updated version of his book, The Lights Upon the Hills, The Burton Dasset UFO Events of 1923, author Richard Rokeby looks into this unusual series of events. Richard, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you, Paul, yeah, and thank you for having me on. It's real pleasure to be with you.
Hey, it's always nice to speak to a fellow northerner, Richard.
That's right. At least we can understand each other, even if nobody else can.
We can discuss the finer points of mushy peas.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yeah, my famous mushy pea story, of course, is Peter Mandelson.
Yes, have with his guacamole.
He had some of that lovely guacamole, and it was in a fish and chip shop. So that's how there's mushy peas.
Absolutely, man of the people, Peter Mandelson.
Yeah, that's right.
Probably why he shaved off that awful moustache he had throughout the 80s.
Yeah, that would be one of the reasons, possibly. There's a few things about Peter Mandelson, I think.
Yes, we'll not go there.
Let's not go there. Yeah.
I've not been sued yet, Richard. I don't want to start in 2024 being sued. Friend, Burton Dasset, as I mentioned in the introduction, is a beautiful little village out in the rural county of Warwickshire, which is one of those places that I think often gets overlooked in certain counties, along with one of your nearer neighbours, Staffordshire, I think, that unless you know the area or you know anything about history, Warwickshire always gets overlooked for everything other than Shakespeare, I suspect.
Yeah, I mean, he is it's Shakespeare at Stratford-upon-Avon is the big seller, if you like. I think that's probably right, Paul. And it does overshadow some of the other stories in the area, and it has its draw, of course, to the theatres and the birthplaces, etc., of Shakespeare. But yeah. You know, like Staffordshire, like Yorkshire, Warwickshire is an ancient place where there have been some form of habitualization, some form of living for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And over that time, you know, the history is seeped into the very ground. So, yeah, I think Warwickshire has its places. There's lots and lots of stories. I do have a weird Warwickshire book in me, I think, at some point in the distant future, maybe. But there is lots of stories around it. But what brought me to Burton Dassett first, really, was the, it started off as a ghost story. So just for your listeners, Burton Dassett is a set of hills, which is now a country park.
Mm.
It was a village in right up until the Middle Ages, until Black Death, the Black Death took its toll. But what's unusual about it, Warwickshire is rolling countryside. I often describe it a bit like the Shire in Lord of the Rings. It's very green, very rolling. But in the western side of the county, we have these five hills that are very prominent in as much as they'd shoot up from the land. And they're not that tall by that high by any standards. I think they're 297 feet is the highest one, which would be Windmill Hill. But the five hills form this sort of area of Burton Dassett, which is maybe only a mile by a mile square. It's not particularly big either. And you've got a church one side, a wood at the other, and then these five hills that you do have to drive or walk very steeply up to get to the top. And I do think it is one of these areas. You mentioned Staffordshire with Cannock Chase or yeah. Rendlesham Forest, Avebury, Stonehenge. It is one of these places, I think, that just seems to attract a lot of phenomena. And originally, the stories that was given out about Burton Dassett were that during 1922, sort of from December 1922 to February 1923, was that there was ghosts up there. People were seeing ghosts, and they were described as lights, different coloured lights, blue, red, white, moving around the hills at different heights, altitudes and speeds. And because of the time when they were being reported, just after the First World War, spiritualism was back on the rise, then people automatically judged them to be ghosts, and that's completely understandable. But I guess when I first found the accounts in a book called The Ghosts of Warwickshire and in the Banbury Gazette, I looking through it, the prism of what we knew now, it seemed to me that it was pretty obvious that it was a mass UFO sighting. And that's certainly how I've sort of investigated it, what the angle I've come from when I've investigated, and when I wrote the book The Lights Upon the Hills.
Yeah. So what was it about that section in the book of Ghosts of Warwickshire, Richard, that this case got under your skin? Because sometimes you can read stories, you know, there was one several years ago that got under my skin, which was one of the reasons I ended up starting the show, really, which was a poltergeist case, which was remarkable, and I couldn't believe I didn't know it. Not that I pretend to be any expert in poltergeist hauntings, but it was such a well-reported one, to the fact that the BBC turned up, it was reported in the States, there was a big cover article of it in Life magazine in the 1950s, that I was just perplexed as to why it wasn't more well-known, and I checked all my books, and it was in two of them. And even over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, when I've carried on cross-referencing it, it doesn't seem to be picked up by people, whether they just overlook it or whatever. And Burton Dassett, I remember a very long time ago reading the work of Jenny Randalls, who made a mention of it. And like you say, a lot of people were kind of just sort of pigeonholing it as a ghost lights kind of encounter, which we often see in the US more than here, Richard. Obviously, the most famous one out there is the Brown Mountain Lights, I would imagine. You've got the Min Min Lights in Australia as well. So it's always good to see some of these cases that get overlooked have a fresh perspective to look at it. So what is it that grabbed you about it? Why did this story propel you to do this book?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. So the book itself, it was written by a local historian, sadly no longer with us, called Betty Smith, who was very well known in Warwickshire for producing these type of books. And within the book, The Ghosts of Warwickshire, there was the normal, you know, if we like to call them normal, ghost stories of grey ladies and devil dogs and headless horsemen and spooky monks and all these sort of things. But then there was just this one chapter, and she called it The Lights on the Hills. And then The Lights on Burton Dassett Hills, she called it. And when I was reading it, I've had an interest in ufology from whence I was a child of the 70s, so influenced very much by Star Wars and E.T. and the Close Encounters and all them sort of things. Where you could, you know, you mentioned your books there, Paul. You can probably remember you had to go to the library and there'd be two books on UFOs. And you were lucky if one of them was in at any one time sort of thing. And you used to get the same book over and over and over again. But yeah, so I used to be one of them kids, really. But yeah, but this just so when I looked at, when I read the story, and it was only two or three pages in her book, but it described these lights moving around and over the hills. But even the reports that she did, they did seem to be in some sort of intelligent control. There was some intelligence behind it. Mm. They were either searching or there was a report of it illuminating a house as if to look for something. And you mentioned the ghost lights, the earth lights, etc. Now, that is a really good point, and it's a point that comes up quite a lot. And Dr. David Clark, he did a paper called Spook Lights back in 1985, him and others. Mm-hmm. And he put them into these lights in the context of these earth lights, which I know you mentioned some there. Some of the Hasseldalen lights in Norway, they're very similar as well. And even closer to home, at the Rollright Stones, which is an ancient monument dating from about the time of Stonehenge, which is only maybe 10 miles away from Burton Dasset.
Yes.
There is reports there of blue, like a blue lightning light type lights that are seen going around this stone circle. But so there is that, and in the book I explain, you know, the other theories that what these lights could be. But it comes down to, for me, is that they were seen, and they were probably seen by hundreds of people, even though we maybe only made eight or nine eyewitnesses, and then about a similar number of press reports as well, which I detail. The thing that stands out is the lights do seem to be acting with some purpose, whether it's searching or there's a report of a motorcycle still in the very early days whizzing around the country lanes into Burton Dasset, and then the motorcyclist sees a similar light, thinks it's another motorbike heading towards him and it's going to crash, but then veers off at the very last minute and shoots off into the sky. So that, to me, there was some empathy there in that light. Didn't want to, it was as shocked as the motorcyclist was. I think it was something's traveling towards me and I've got to get out of the way. So it moved up. And then there's another report. So there's George White and two friends. George White is a local man from Burton Dasset. He decides with his friends he's going to go up onto the hills and disprove these reports of lights that have been seen. But he goes up there and with his field glasses, he sees these lights, and then he reports to the local paper, the Banbury Gazette, this one was, saying how the lights, he felt them go over him. And I just thought that word, felt, was key, because that to me is a change of atmosphere. It's downward pressure. It's atmospherics. You know, it's showing it's something more tangible, perhaps, than marsh gas or swamp gas or even earth lights. You know, it's something that is emitting a presence in the field around them. So there was these sort of reports, and I just felt that this is a story that needed more, a bit like yourself and the Poltergeist case. It needed, it warranted further investigation and a book. It was originally going to be an article in 2019 when I wrote the original book. It was going to be a few articles, but I did a lot more research since there, and a lot more that I wanted to put into the book. So what I've done is just update the book with all the research I had and gone a bit further with the paper reports and with things like spook lights. So it just warranted a bit more investigation, I think. And the more I found out, the more I'm convinced it was UFO in origin. Now, I know that's a UFO is now a huge sort of genre now, which can include interdimensional, you know, ultra-terrestrial, you know, time travel, all these sort of things. But it was certainly one of them type of events rather than a ghost event or an Earthlight event.
Yeah. I think one of the key aspects of this particular case, as you refer to there, Richard, is that we've got numerous newspaper articles from the time, eyewitnesses. I know that there were some people, because adjacent to Burton Dassett, you've got the wonderfully named Fenny Compton, which is one of those beautiful named places that we have here in the UK. And Warwickshire seems to be dotted with some wonderfully named places, as Derbyshire is as well, and some of the places around Yorkshire, you get some wonderful names.
Yeah, Snitterfield is a good one.
Yeah.
There's a place called Snitterfield, which is just up towards Stratford.
And so it's interesting when you look back that you seem to have people from both vantage points, because I know there were some reports of people in the Fenny Compton side looking towards Bassett, and people in Bassett looking towards Fenny Compton. They both seem to be able to see this, which kind of makes you think, well, that, because I know, as you were saying there about some of the plausible explanations that were put forward, a lot of people have said, oh, well, maybe they were just seeing lights from the other village. And I thought, well, why would they? It's one of those things, Richard, that you think, well, are we expected to believe that everybody in this area was an idiot and didn't understand light for all of a sudden in 1922? Because sometimes you scratch your head and you think, well, yes, that is a plausible, rational explanation. But it's based on the fact that you're presuming then that all these people that saw these things were idiots.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, what springs to mind is the lighthouse in Rendlesham.
Yes.
And the people, you know, these are trained observers that have been around the world, you know, those American airmen. And someone says, oh, well, it must have been a lighthouse. And then that's the end of it. But yeah, so I do sympathize. I know what you mean. Yeah. I think once, if you were just to get the headline, light seen Burton Dassett, then you say, oh, well, the lights in the other village, or, you know, either the motorbike lights or the early car lights flying around. But when you dig into the reports, like George White's report, where he's seen lights move around at speed and then go over him, or the motorcyclist where there's a light that shoots off into the sky. There is my favourite. So heading out towards Fenny Compton, there's a place called Night Court, which really was there for the railway, and it was a signal box. And there was a signalman in there called, we now know what he's called W. Corbett. And he was a signalman on duty one day, February 1923, and he describes a orange orb, so slightly different from the small white, blue, red light, but an orange orb coming down from Burton Dassett and basically stopping and hovering in front of his signal box. And he doesn't know what to do. And he phones the station, the railway station, and says, is this orange light just stopped outside my signal box? And they say, phone the police. So he phones the police and tells them. And he actually says, look, I'm going to go out and face this light in a minute and chase it off, because it was all near the railway line. So he's obviously thinking it's a danger to the railways that are coming through. And he goes out armed with one of these giant spanners that they use for adjusting the signals. And fortunately for both parties, perhaps, the light floats off back towards Burton Dassett Hill. But you know, for him to do that, for him to take that risk back then, where it's a very responsible job, and if you lost your job, that was it, you lost your livelihood, for him to report that is phenomenal. I think it's a really good eyewitness account, and you know, that can't be mistaken really for much else, other than, you know, in its literal sense, an unidentified flying object. Now where the origin from is, you know, is for massive discussion, but you know, these objects that were seen were not of that time, and could not be explained away by anything else but that, really.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that particular witness, Richard, because I know, once again, as we're talking about plausible explanations, there was this very ill-fated train line that was apparently somebody was trying to construct around that period. And so people have mistakenly said, oh, well, people were probably not used to seeing trains, which is one of those things. What? It's, you know, it's 1922. It's not, it's not 1846. I think everybody knew what a train was, and especially in those days, steam trains. This is not an industrial area. It's a very as we've said in the beginning. It's a very rural, beautiful area. It's now a country park. It's peaceful. It's calm. It's one of those lovely little places that you find these pockets in the UK of just beautiful greenery, tranquility even, Richard. And so for the signalman to be one of the witnesses claiming that he could see this thing bobbing about surely completely negates this railway explanation, because surely if somebody knows what a train is, it's going to be the signalman.
Yes, yeah, yes, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the trains are key to this area. It was on the London to Birmingham line, and this is when steam trains are at its height, very evocative of the period, really.
Hmm.
People would know what a steam train is, but what is interesting about the railway is, so back during the war, so the hills themselves are basically built on iron ore.
Hmm.
Even in the dark ages, there's these big scoops out of the earth that are littered around the country park, which were originally thought to be burial grounds, but I have good authority they're not. They're open cast iron ore mines. From the dark ages, really.
Hmm.
Even during the First World War, they did put a railway line up to the top of to Burton Dasset, where iron ore was being brought out for use during the war. And then since then, we also have MOD Kyneton.
Yes.
So within this area, which is why I think you've got to look at it holistically. So within the area, we've also got, since 1943, MOD Kyneton, which is currently, it's one of the biggest ammunition stores of the His Majesty's Forces. So, you know, not just the army, it holds ammunition for the RAF and for Navy as well, because it is quite central. And they have around about, I think it's 76 miles of track just around Kyneton itself, MOD Kyneton itself, for moving ammunition from the camp onto the main lines and taking it around to the various different bases.
Hmm.
So railway lines always have had an important role to play in the area. And just going back a step onto the, you know, we mentioned about the earthlights. I mean, my next best theory after UFOs is the earthlights, because what I think is interesting is clearly the ground has had a lot of attention over thousands of years, people digging into it, etc. And these lights were seen up until February 1973, and then they stopped, and they haven't really at all been seen since. But about a month after the lights were seen, there was an earthquake in Warwickshire, that area of Warwickshire, Burton Dasset. And again, that sort of suggests, you know, was it the land that was playing up a bit?
Mm.
I don't think it's earthlights from the sort of reasons I've already given, but it is very interesting as to what the land contributes to the story. Because the other thing I've wrote about in the book is the idea that the three hills on the western side of Burton Dasset, Bonfire Hill, Windmill Hill and Church Hill, they face the western side, but they're in a very specific pattern that matches Orion's belt. So you've got these two in a row and then one slightly offset, just as it does. It matches the Giza pyramids, which again could be massively coincidental, except in February, the constellation of Orion is directly above the hills, and the three stars of Orion's belt seem to match up with the three hills on the floor.
Mm.
So, you know, that could be just a weird coincidence again. But when you look at everything else, the sightings, the MOD camp, the church, which I'm sure I'll come on to, you know, all these sort of things tied together that say that, you know, there is something very special going on in that area.
Mm. I think it's interesting when you look at the wider aspects of that, Richard, that sometimes you can look at places and think, why on earth is there a church here? Because it's usually in the middle of nowhere, or it's in somewhere that you wouldn't normally expect. I think probably one of the best examples I can think of off the top of my head is Rudston, which is out towards Bridlington. And there they've got the largest stone monolith in the United Kingdom, but not many people know it's there.
Yeah.
And it's one of those places that it's clearly been attractive to civilizations and populations for millennia, because they believe the Rudston monolith, I think, is about 3,000 years old. It's certainly a good 1,000 years BC when it was taken there, because it's not even local stone. It was dragged there. I think it came from Whitby, if my memory serves me right. But not only have you got this incredible monolith where most of it is underground as well now, in the same area, literally within, I don't know, 30 yards of this, you've got Roman graves. And these two things are all inside the boundary of Rudston Church. So the church was built next to the Roman graves that were built next to the monolith. So three completely different cultures, three completely different belief systems, all found this area magnetic, if you will. And so when you've got a little area like this, you would say to yourself, well, why would you have a church here? Because, as I said in the introduction, Burton Dasset is not a large place. I know, obviously, that we mentioned Fenny-Compton is slightly larger, but this is not an area full of people, Richard, is it?
No, it isn't. And, you know, you identify that really well in terms of it is a strange place to have a church. And the church is sort of halfway up the hill, so the far end of the hill, halfway up Church Hill. You have to, as you go onto the hills, you then got to go down a road that leads you to the church. And the church is called All Saints Church. It was mentioned in the Domesday Book, which I think was 1087, as a small Saxon nave. Mm-hmm. And you're on about sites being built on top of sites. There's actually a holy well next to the church, which was originally a Roman well. So it was originally a Roman temple on there. I think most cultures would recognize, as I described it earlier on, that it gives you a height advantage, so it's worth occupying. So, you know, not just the Romans, but later on the Saxons occupied it. There was a Roman well, a Roman temple on that area, and then the church has appeared after it. And in fact, I read a report of the what's now known as Windmill Hill was known as Phoenix Hill, because the story of that dates back to apparently Roman times, when red lights were seen around the hill, and the Romans called it Phoenix Hill.
Uh-huh.
But the church itself was just a normal, quite small Saxon nave until the 14th century, where it received a massive uplift, a massive investment from probably the Knights Templar that were based at a place called Temple Herdwick, which is basically on the site of where MOD Kyneton is today. And they enlarged it, and it began to be known as the Cathedral in the Cotswolds. because of the size of it, and when you walk into it, it's expansive, but quite Spartan, really. It's quite sparse when you get in there. But there is these unusual carvings and these paintings, which I believe tells a very old and deep story.
I mean, there you are. I mean, we've got this because the Romans were quite, whilst they liked to pretend they were men of science and very learned, they also had some deeply held superstitions and beliefs, like you say, in regards to holy wells and things like that. And for them to have, once again, why would they be there? What is, you know, unless they also, as you were referring to earlier about the iron ore in the local area, were they aware of that? Was it a reason that they wanted to be there? Is it one of those places where they thought, well, this is a nice place for an outpost? We've got, well, particularly around that area, because these are some of the largest hills in the particular area. So I suppose if you chose the right area, you would have a phenomenal vantage point for everything around you. You could see people coming from miles away.
Yeah, I think that's probably why the Romans took it. So again, in Warwickshire, it's not that well known for Roman ruins, but we have a thing called Lunt Fort, which is just outside Coventry, near the airport at Coventry.
Yes.
And you know, new research on that says that it was probably one of the largest horse training areas in Britain during the Roman times. You know, it was probably one of the centres of horse collection and rearing and training for the troops and the cavalry that were brought in. It was like a huge riding school.
Hmm.
And they're getting more and more information now. And then just further east of that is, of course, the Watling Road, which is now the A5. And again, research is beginning to think that the battle with Boadicea happened somewhere in that area. I mean, the battlefield has always been sort of lost to history, but a bit of research suggests that it could have been in the Midlands area, partway along the Watling Road. And then if you put that together, the Watling Road and Lunt Fort, where all your horses and cavalry are, then it would make perhaps sense that the Romans would meet them in that sort of area. So, yes, it's as you get, there's Chedworth as well, I think, which is a Roman villa, which is out down towards the Cotswolds. So there is a Roman presence in the area. Why they were brought to Burntdown, I can only think it was military reasoning, really, in as much as it's easy defendable, it gives you a view, you know, 360 view, really, of the whole landscape. So I think that's probably why they were there. But they then had to find this well, so and then believe it had mystical properties. So what originated that? Could it been, you know, the lights that was seen on what was known as Phoenix Hill? Could that have been what set it off? And I don't know. It's extremely interesting, but again, it goes back to this idea that this area is a bit special.
Mm. So I know, as you referred to there about the Romans claiming to have seen strange lights bobbing about, which gave it, you know, if you, it makes you wonder, obviously, that why they would associate that area with a phoenix. I know that obviously sometimes the Romans would use such a creature on their emblems and their shields, depending on which garrison they were in and the like. So clearly, the Burton Dasset, the 1922-1923 sightings are part of a longer history, and as you referred to, it was seen after that as well. I suppose, Richard, when you start this investigation and you've got this centre point, as it were, for this particular period and these witnesses that we got 100 years ago, as you've delved into it, have you started to go backwards as well as forwards to see, were they repeated? Is this one of those wonderfully weird phenomena that doesn't happen all the time? It happens every so often, as you refer to. I know, as we were touching on the earth lights explanation, and seismic stresses can occur over a long period of time, and that's perhaps why they're not as regular, if you believe that particular explanation. Or is it just because I'm often perplexed by these sort of sporadic cases when we don't have a regularity to it that we have with certain other events, as you mentioned Hessendalen earlier, which is one of those phenomena that some people just dismiss completely out of hand. And I find it incredible that if you see any of the footage of that, Richard, it's a remarkable, whatever it is going on up there in Norway, is incredible, whether that's some kind of seismic response or it's some kind of atmospheric situation going on there. Whatever's going on, it's both mysterious and beautiful.
Yeah, and one of the best studied.
Yes.
You know, the university dedicates a team, the local university dedicates teams, you know, for a long time, winter after winter, to go up and research them. I think it's fallen out a bit in favour now. It's not to say that it's not happening.
Mm.
But it was extremely well researched and recorded and, you know, a real sort of scientific approach to it. So, yeah, I would agree in terms of the Hasseldalen lights that it is a phenomenon that's worthy of a lot more investigation. In terms of Burton Dasset, I do think that it's reoccurring, but it's in timescales that we would struggle to keep up with. If we think that the, you know, the report of Phoenix Hill and the red lights there in Roman times, I think the next stage it's recorded, I believe, is within the paintings within All Saints Church. So there is 14th century paintings in there that depict probably, in my research, two kings from the 9th century AD. So Saxon kings, King Oswald and King Ethelbert, both became saints, which is why they're depicted in a church. But what's interesting about them two depictions, Saint Ethelbert was originally from Northumbria, actually, mm-hmm. and then moved, was due to be wed to King of Mercia's daughter, but wouldn't renounce his Christian faith, so was beheaded.
Mm.
And there was lots of stories of he was eventually buried in Hereford Cathedral. And there's lots of stories of as his body was being moved to Hereford Cathedral, the head also, which was separated from his shoulders, yes. By then there was a number of different maybe they needed two boxes, I don't know, but there was a number of different miracles along the way, including lights being seen. So what makes us think is one figure is him, is he's holding a head. It's one figure holding a head. And then the other figure is the church would say would be a wise man, a magi from the Christmas story.
Yes.
Other people would say it's St. Oswald, who was a Christian king around about the 9th century AD, who died in battle, I think, again, sort of Mercia way. But this figure is holding, and I'll come to that in a minute, but he's holding an orb in his left hand. So there is an orb that looks a bit like a bottle, sort of starts out, you know, at the bottom it's sort of bulging, then narrows a bit, and it looks a bit like a child's top as well. And there, yes, is undulating lines on it, which to me suggests sort of rotation movement. But yeah, the official story for the churches would be that that is a magi with one of the gift for the Christ child. But it's on its own. There was nothing else that would suggest a sort of Christmas theme. And I think when you look at it very carefully, not giving away too much for the book, but if you look at it very carefully, you'll see that you can see that this object, whatever it is, on the king's hand is not resting on the king's hand. It's floating around. And, you know, to me, that is something. Is it representing an object that was flying, floating in the area back in the 9th century that has been captured by 14th century artists, you know, displaying a well-known legend of the area of flying items, flying objects within that area? So some people would say that that's a stretch, but when you look at it again, taken in context with everything else, I do think that's what it's depicting. And with the new book, I was very keen with the new book to get color photos in the new book, so people can look at it themselves and, you know, make their own mind up. You can see there has been some erosion, whether deliberate or just over the passage of time, between where the object was and the king's hand. But it's very clear that the king's hand is at one level and the bottom of the object is 2 or 3 inches above. So in terms of the story of when this phenomenon happens, I do think it happens, you know, over periods of times, perhaps thousands of years, 500 years. I was perhaps hoping that on the 100th anniversary, which has been this year,
yeah,
that we'd get a major site. I'd love to see that mothership came down on top of the, yes, but it didn't. You know, it was I'd love to say like something like Close Encounters landed on top of that's the hills, but it wasn't like anything like that at all, yeah, like Devil's Tower. But you know, but that's because, you know, 100 years is nothing likely to,
yeah,
you know, these entities that are responsible for the lights.
Mm. I suppose as well, Richard, when you have things like this that seem to happen on specific dates and specific times of year, have you managed to see if there's been any kind of, after the immediate reported flap 100 years ago, was it one of those where people would, because I know one of the key things about this, about how many people saw these, even though we've got, as you say, half a dozen published witness accounts, people were coming from miles around because this story spread like wildfire in the area. So people were coming specifically to look for these lights for quite a long period. Was it that it seemed to continue being an attraction to people for a specific period of time afterwards, and then eventually they just all drifted away because it wasn't as regular as it first appeared in those early reports?
Yeah, I think something like that did happen. You're right, in as much as people were travelling far and wide to come up and see the lights, not just locals, but reporters were being sent from Birmingham, from London. London Times sent reporters up because they heard the story of these lights. So it became national news, really.
Hmm.
And the reporters were seeing them. There's a great account of a London Times reporter who's talking to the locals until it's just about to turn dark, and then goes up on the hills, you know, perhaps quite cynical, thinking, well, you know, what is going on here? Is it just the locals messing about? You know, wanders around but doesn't say anything particularly, you know, that would describe these lights. And then before going down back off the hills, he stands on Windmill Hill, looks out, just the view, and at that point he sees a golden orb come through the clouds and illuminate the cloud base and then fly off at speed. And that's what he writes about.
Hmm.
You know, so people, which you can imagine, can't you, with the turning of dusk, you know, and this light just dropping down from the clouds. You wouldn't have seen anything like that. You know, planes can't do that. It must have been an incredible sight. And he goes back and writes up about it straight away, and it makes into the sort of Times, into his report. But in terms of that, then people are coming up, and it was a bit of a pastime then to go up. It wasn't, you know, lights had been reported elsewhere, particularly around Welsh churches, and so it wasn't that unusual. People would walk up to these places on an evening, on a Sunday afternoon, to see what if they could see anything. But it does seem as though by the end of February, the reports have more or less stopped. And I think that's why Dr. David Clark refers to it as a flap, in as much as it was very exciting for these 2 or 3 months, and then it just sort of stops. So it probably was that the lights weren't seen after that. But thankfully, they were recorded.
Mm. I suppose as well, when we're talking about this particular period of time, as you touched on there, Richard, this is 1923, so we know that the only aeroplanes that were in the sky at that particular time were biplanes. Very noisy, very rickety. I'm not aware many of them had any lighting, to be fair, back in those days. Because, you know, we're talking about something essentially held together with bits of string and wire. I'm not really sure they'd have much call for electronics on their wings.
No.
It's not going to be crewed airships. It's very doubtful. I mean, this is another thing that I've seen people say, oh, well, it was a hot air balloon. I'm not aware of many people that take a risk of flying a hot air balloon in the at night.
In February.
Yeah, that low to the ground as well.
Yeah.
We know it can't be fireworks because none of the witnesses describe noises. So we know it's possibly not mechanical. Once again, this also refers back to the railway. Nobody's talking about hearing any noises. They just see about these lights. And then when you couple it to the reporter from the Times seeing it illuminate the clouds around it, and as you mentioned earlier on in our conversation, this house where the light seemed to sort of be attracted to it and sort of light it up.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there is lots of reports that, I mean, the explanation that was given at the time was, you know, the ufologist's nemesis of swamp gas or marsh gas, and that came from a report by George Cottrell, who was a local groom who was leading a horse down towards the other village, which is North End, and on just at the foot of the hills there is a pond there. There was a pond there. It's not there anymore. And he described how he saw a purplish coloured light that sort of startled the horse and had the horse jumping around. And that report made it into a paper via a reporter. What I've found out since was that that reporter then went to Fenny Compton and found a local that had also seen the light, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, a similar purple light, zipping through. He'd come out of it doesn't help this, to be honest, Paul, but he comes out of a pub and sees a purple light zipping around in front of him. I mean, we've all been there. But the I think the thing is, it's so recent after George Cottrell's sighting, which sort of corroborates that original sighting. But from that report, that's when this marsh gas hypothesis gets put forward. Well, it's probably all marsh gas, but no doubt you know, and some of your listeners will go, marsh gas, dysperforous gas, I think it's pronounced, is a real phenomenon, but it's very, very difficult to reproduce, and it's generally in hot, wet climates. Now, it might have been wet around the pond, but certainly not hot in February in Warwickshire. And also it tends to be very much a flash or literally seconds long, where a lot of these lights were seen over periods of time, sort of moving around. So there is that report, and that sort of idea was put forward. Perhaps it was marsh gas. But the theory I like now is, and again, I know we were talking about him earlier, which I think is a phrase that was coined by Paul Sinclair, who does some fantastic work on the Northeast Coast, of this intelligent light form. And increasingly, I'm heading in that direction, that maybe what we saw were intelligent light forms, because they interact with people. I mean, you mentioned it lighting up a house. There's another story, which was of a maid that worked in the vicarage. And originally, that was just one or two lines in Betty Smith's book. But yeah, I think there was a bit more put forward in Spook Lights, where although we didn't get the name of the maid, she told the story to her great granddaughter, who recounted the story. And there was a lot more to it. It turned out this maid would often see the lights going along the hills, and on one occasion she sort of watched one as she walked into the vicarage, and then went into the kitchens of the vicarage, and then would pop out, and as she popped out, the light would appear again, and she'd go back in, startled, and then a few minutes later she'd pop out, and the light would appear again. It would pop out from behind a hill. So there was some sort of communication going on. It was like waiting for her, which I find incredible, really. But again, that does lend itself to this intelligent life form. And in my updated book, I've included an account by a commercial pilot who it's never a story. It's never been published before, and it's based on an account of when this pilot, who's only known as Pilot A, when he was flying cargo flights between Southampton and Hamburg, I think it was, and him and his co-pilot saw two green headlamp sized lights, but more fuzzy, in the air. They saw them out of the plane they were flying's window. They knew something was wrong, because I guess most people know that you get red and green lights on the tip of wings of other aircraft, but this was two together, and they were on the wrong side, which meant that the aircraft would have had to have been flying backwards for them to approach him. So he knew they weren't right. And one light goes over the top, one light goes underneath. And it's amazing account in itself, but he then goes on to detail what happened, he thinks, to that other light form and how it interacted with him for a few years going forward, which, again, you'll forgive me if I don't want to give too much away, but it's quite an incredible story he details. And so I increasingly, although originally I still think there's a possibility that lights were maybe some sort of probe. So the probes tend to be what we're doing now, is sending probes up to new planets. You know, people like Avi Loeb, we are talking about, if there was extraterrestrial contact, it'd probably be via probe first. So whether these lights were a bit more nuts and bolts and were actually probes is what is one hypothesis. But my increasing one is because of these interactions that perhaps there was some form of intelligent life form.
I mean, as you mentioned there, the marsh gas, swamp gas, whichever kind of phenomenon people try and use that as an explanation, I often think, have these people ever actually seen swamp gas combust? Because I have. I've done it myself. And basically, you can just get a naked flame, but you've got to have the right sort of chemicals being released through through the normal sort of natural process of decay for it to release the right mix to make it flammable. And when you do it, it just goes... Woof. It's like a ball of flame. It's like when you turn on your gas hob on your cooker, Richard.
And
sometimes you've left the gas on a little too long and it just goes poof.
Yeah.
And then it settles down. It doesn't fly up in a ball. It doesn't levitate. It just combusts and then it's gone.
Yeah.
And I've never understood how people think that is a theoretical explanation for something as different as that. Because if we're talking about light forms, balls of light, strange lights in the sky, intelligent lights, whatever... The reality of marsh gas, swamp gas does not match that. It doesn't work like that. And the other bugbear that always gets me is when people say, oh, well, such and such had been to the pub and they'd had 3 pints and then they saw these strange lights in the sky. And they go, oh, well, you know, alcohol makes you hallucinate. I know as an ex-landlord of pubs in my younger days, Richard.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
For the vast majority of people to hallucinate through alcohol, you would have to be close to death for that. You would need enough alcohol to near enough kill you. And I think the last thing you'd be doing is looking up at the sky, because you'd be laying on the floor being extremely ill and needing hospital treatment, Richard. So I've had that confirmed by medical practitioners and people who work in the medical services. So I know that's a fact. You know, you've got to have a severe amount of alcohol to even do that, unless every witness is an alcoholic, because then you start getting the vapors, as they used to call it, and you start seeing strange things anyway. And I find that very hard to believe, especially in an era where alcohol was hard to get hold of. It wasn't like these days where you can get it 24 hours a day, Richard. So these are all plausible explanations until you... I mean, this is sometimes the thing that frustrates me about cases such as this one, Richard, is that when people do put forward rational explanations, people just go, oh, well, that's where it is then. They don't scrutinize it as they would do as say your book is saying and what these people were reporting. People go, oh, no, that's ridiculous. It's this. Well, just because you put forward a theory doesn't mean it can't be scrutinized. Just because it's a rational explanation doesn't mean it can't be evaluated, checked, and compared to what the people are seeing. Because once you start to do that, as we've said about the train, airplanes, weather balloons, marsh gas, when you put them all under the test, they all fail to match the sightings.
As a former police officer, I can certainly corroborate about there is a lot of stages people go through of drinking. And there is the I love you, you're my best mate, to the I'm going to fight everybody in the street stage, to the falling over drunk stage. You know, there is very rarely the seeing the lights in the sky for this, in my experience. But, I completely corroborate that. But, the marsh gas one, I mean, I know we're going off topic a bit here, but, even this was meant, I wonder if this was the first time it was mentioned, you know, about it being marsh gas back in the 1920s, because that's certainly what the London Times sort of put forward as to what it could be. Whether, you know, Alan J. Hynek and Blue Book picked it up from the Burton Dassets, because this event, I don't know, but they seem to populate it. I mean, I do mention in the book, which I think is the Michigan sightings of 1967 or something.
Yes.
Where all sorts were seen, craft moving over lakes, people were being abducted left, right and centre. There was a triangle craft seen by a police officer, a truck driver and I think his son as well, all giving these really credible accounts. And at a public meeting, Hendrick said it was marsh gas.
Mm.
And that more or less lost his credibility. I mean, they went very quiet after that Blue Book and eventually disappeared. And then he reinvented himself as a sort of ufologist, really. So, it is one of these things, the marsh gas, swamp gas theory that, you know, we're not getting it now, but no doubt it'll reoccur, you know, sooner or later.
Yeah, yeah. That was the case that, essentially, that was the ufological equivalent of the straw that broke the camel's back for Hyde.
It was, yeah.
Because it finished him off, because I think that's the Dexter Lights case in Michigan. And the thing about that is, once again, as you mentioned there, Richard, there's photos of what people were seeing over Dexter at the time. And they're like rods. They're like straight lines of bright white light.
I haven't seen them, but that's interesting, yeah.
And it was all happening around a farm. And he got a lake or a pond, I think, on the farm. And that's where it all came from. And they said, what everybody is seeing around here. This included policemen as well. I think it was a police officer who took some of the photos, Richard.
Oh, right, okay.
And it was that case that the whole swamp gas explanation came out of, and obviously finished him off. Blue Book finished a couple of years afterwards. And then after that, he went, he basically went from skeptic to believer because...
That's right, yeah.
He wasn't comfortable putting forward an explanation that he clearly thought was nonsense, which it was, because as I was saying about the explanations for the lights seen over Bassett, it doesn't match what people are saying. It's a reasonable explanation until you put it to the test, and then it doesn't match.
Mm-hmm. Mm. No, that is a good way of putting it, and you make a good point there about he Hynek was probably told to say that.
Yeah,
and he knew it was, you know, it was new. It was the beginning of the end, I think.
Yes.
But he couldn't. I mean, I've seen footage of that, and no doubt you have, and he doesn't even sound convinced himself.
No.
But he's been told to say that, but. That's what I like about, you know, going back to my very original point at the start of the interview, is that's what I like about this story. There is so many elements to it. It's not just lights in the sky. It's the fact that you've got a fantastic church with all its own mysteries. I mean, you've got the carvings as well there that some depict animals upside down as if they're being levitated, and the green man's in there, and half men, half lizard beasts are being depicted. You've got the pictures, you've got this military base that appeared after the sightings. But you know, I've had my own experiences where I go up onto the area regularly, talk to the locals, have a look around myself, and on one occasion I was basically chased off by two people in a black Land Rover, black Range Rover, you know, and which I detail in the book, which is quite an experience. And you know, so there's a witch's circle there now, which again I detail in the book.
Yeah,
you know, there's all these sort of elements in this very, very small area that are fascinating, really.
I suppose as well, there's one other aspect of all this that we've not touched on whatsoever, which is 20 miles away from Burton Dassett is Leamington Spa, which is the birthplace of Aleister Crowley.
He is, yeah, it is. Well done, yeah. Yes, yes. So you can go and see his house.
Yes.
I mean, he spent his childhood there.
Yeah.
I think he was about 7 when he left.
Mm.
I don't think he spent a lot of time there, but I've only found that out in the last year or two, I think, that he was there, but he would have been influenced by it. And you know, I mentioned witchcraft, you know, that I do tours up there, and so if you ever want a, you know, this is an open invitation,
yes,
really, but I might regret it, but if people email me and want to meet me there,
yeah,
I take people around and talk about the area, etc. And I took two other authors up there, actually. And this would have been about May 2022. And we went to this area of the woods. It's this Fox Covert wood, which is quite a small wood, but halfway around the path that you walk, there is a natural sort of amphitheater there made by trees, you know. It's a bit of a clearing, and you can sort of have a wander around it. But on this occasion we went into it, and on a tree that sort of signaled the start of it, there was a pentagram in a circle, and on the floor there was a dotted white line and then a solid white line either side of a route, really. And it was pretty obvious this was an entrance and an exit into the area. So we went through, and then in the middle, where you've got all these trees, in the middle tree there was another pentagram. Now I was pretty reassured, because it was I don't know how much you know about this, but the pentagram symbol, if it's like a traditional five-pointed star with a point at the top, that generally means pagan on Wicca. Mm. So it's a bit safer. If it's turned slightly so you've got two points up, that's generally representing the devil, etc. Mm. So this was, I think, a pagan or Wicca site, but it had very strange markings sprayed onto the trees. There was little man-made areas that had been made with branches, etc., that you back two people could sit in, and there'd been a fire there. So it was quite a big area, and around about 10 or 11 trees were marked up with either letters or symbols. So it was clearly, it'd been used as a Wicca / pagan site as well. Mm. So I thought that was really interesting. I detail about it in the book, because there was a couple of satanic murders as well. One was in Femi Compton. I think actually they were both in Femi Compton. One was during the 1940s, where a very mild-mannered man suddenly lost it and pitchforked somebody, a woman in the street, for no apparent reason. 1947, I think that was. But a pitchforking is a traditional way of killing a witch.
Yes.
And then in 18, sort of turn of the 19th century, 1897, something like that, a policeman went missing from Ferny Compton and was found 2 weeks later in the Oxford Canal, and he'd been pitchforked to death. So again, you've got these two satanic murders. You know, I go into a bit more detail in the book, but so you have got this now, this connection with. Now, I know paganism and Wicca are very, very different from Satanism, which you imagine is eventually what Crowley ended up as,
yes,
if the reports are true. Mm. But it does show that there is that link there. And what I find really interesting is the area where we found this witch's circle is exactly a mirror image to where the church is. So they're just the other side of the hill.
Ah.
And if you could draw a straight line between them if the hill wasn't there. And whether that's deliberate or not, I don't know, but I suspect it is deliberate. So, yeah, so there's lots of these interesting stories within Warwickshire. And Aleister Crowley, well, is another hour's topic there, isn't it, Paul, for another show, perhaps?
Absolutely, at least an hour. And that's probably before we get onto anything else about him. He's, notorious.
Yeah.
One of the few subjects I've not touched on yet. But
I think that I know we're going off topic here, but he's a philosopher. You know, he is known for these satanic rites that he did and ceremonies and stuff. But he was also a writer, an explorer, philosopher.
Yeah.
He wrote a lot of philosophy books. He explored, I think it was Tibet and India.
Yeah.
As a younger man, he was quite a successful businessman in his own way. You know, but very, very interesting guy. But you know, if you're going to do satanic rituals, that's what you're going to remember for, aren't you?
Yes.
No matter what else you do, he's going to be like, you mean the bloke who does satanic rituals? Yeah, that's the one.
When he's not mucking around Loch Ness or believing he's the reincarnation of an Egyptian pharaoh amongst many, many that's things he did. There's not much Crowley didn't do.
So I was listening to something the other day and they seem pretty sure he'd done human sacrifices at some point.
Mm.
Well, I don't know where the evidence is, but yeah, there was an interesting.
Yeah, was that the scandal when he had that villa in Italy, and there was supposed to be something that happened there? I'm not sure. To be fair, I've not delved too much into Crowley. I've got enough weird things bouncing around in my head without delving much further into Alistair's history. But that does ring a bell. I know there was a real incident, because I'm sure they got kicked out of Italy over what happened. He had to get repatriated by the British consulate, I'm sure.
Flipping heck. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that sounds about... sounds about right. But he had these followers as well, didn't he? And I can't remember what his church was called, but it certainly seemed to have been the foundation for a lot of satanic churches that sprung up after him. They're still on the go today. So another local. We've got William Shakespeare on one hand and then Aleister Crowley on the other. So make of that what you will.
From the sublime to the ridiculous and everything in between, yeah, I think, Richard. So I suppose with you diving into this particular case, and as you said, your interest in ufology and strange things and some of the other weird and wonderful things that you've uncovered, which are perhaps suggest that you weren't expecting to come across, as you were mentioning there, some of these weird witchcraft-based murders and pitchforkings of people, which is a very odd... It's a very similar kind of phenomenon that reminds me of some of the really strange murder cases from the US at the birth of the 20th century, where you've got a lot of families being slaughtered by an axe. And it's that kind of personal sort of taking of someone's life. And obviously with your experience being a former police officer, Richard, these are strange things for people to use in that kind of situation. So it would sort of, it makes you scratch your head and just think, is there just something in the water that affects certain people, or is it the atmosphere, or is it just one of those things? It's a strange thing. So has it given you a thirst to uncover more weirdness in the locality?
Yeah, I think so, yes. I said earlier, I think there's definitely a book in me called Weird Warwickshire where I detail a lot of events. So yeah, just from around me. I mean, there's a really interesting UFO sighting from just up the road, literally 4 or 5 miles away, at the outskirts of Coventry, a place called Canley. Meriden. And that happened during the Second World War. And it was originally an account in, we mentioned him earlier on, John Hansen's excellent Haunted Skies books.
Yes.
So he did an account there, which, again, there's only 3 or 4 pages, but it was a lady that during the war was cycling. I think she was cycling to the factories in Coventry, where she would have been. Well, obviously, Coventry was a big industrial area.
Yeah.
And she sort of was cycling through down a road past a field. And she looked to her left and saw a big, huge floating dish there, like a UFO, your flying saucer, typical flying saucer, with two men. Or humanoid type figures, but wearing what we describe as spacesuits and like helmets, like fire retardant helmets on top of the head.
Yeah.
And basically, it does sound a strange account, but this lady said, the chap said, "Oh, all right, off to work, are you?" Something like just passing the time. And then she said, "Yeah, I'm going good." And it struck up a conversation. And She says how that from that point she had these encounters with these humanoid creatures. She describes them as being quite human looking, but quite tall, taller than normal humans, paler, round faces, bald heads, or wearing these sort of suits. But she saw them later on. She details in her account that he actually this creature. Alien, extraterrestrial, for want of a better word, came to see her at her work one day, and she showed him around, and then in return, he picked her up and took her on the ship, and showed her these screens, and it basically laid out how the war was going to end with a nuclear explosion, and what was going to happen afterwards. But she died, I think, maybe 20 years ago, but she maintained that she had these encounters throughout her whole life, all of which were detailed, all of which were sort of not corroborated as much as other people saw them, but the family would say, "Oh yes, she's always talking about Anne," and she'd always make notes. It's a bit like that chap in Switzerland that I can't remember his name now, that used to go out and speak with the Venusians and all that sort of stuff and took these pictures.
Billy Meyer,
yeah. He and there was reports of him. He would load his gun up, wouldn't he? And put it into his belt and then say, "Right there, you," and he'd go off and then he'd disappear for hours.
Yeah.
And then he'd come back again.
Yeah.
And say, "Well, this is what I've been..." So this report from just like a Warwickshire housewife.
Yeah.
Was just, but it's a really interesting thing, and she detailed it throughout her whole life. And there's she could be making it up, of course, but even back in when there was a war on, I would have thought she'd have better things to do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Especially living near Coventry. But
yeah.
So yeah, and I there is these sort of incredible stories around. And that's one of my favourites, I think, from around here.
Yeah, yeah. I think there are lots of stories like that, Richard, all over the UK that have just been kind of sidelined or ignored because they're a bit odd and they're not a nuts and bolts UFO case, or they're not a typical sort of encounter or abduction story. They're weird and they've got these weird sorts of relationships in them, or they're strange looking creatures.
Yeah.
Like the one, I think it 1963, and they saw that group of teenagers saw that bat-like creature that was shuffling around behind a bush. And terrified them all. And I've seen people say, oh, well, they were just pretending they'd just heard about Mothman. But the problem is, it happened 3 years before the Mothman. So are we saying that these kids were time travelers and they went back in time to pull a joke? I mean, that explanation is one of those, once again, it's a rational explanation till you look at the case and realise it couldn't possibly be that. Because and to be fair, why would a newspaper in the UK be covering something happening in a sleepy town called Point Pleasant?
And that's the thing. It takes a lot for people to report this, I think.
Yes.
You know, it's, again, with my experience as a police officer, you can tell when people are being genuine or when they're making it up. And I always think, and I apply this a lot with UFO cases, less is more for me.
Yeah.
So, you know, this lady in her account from the Meriden one, it's so a matter of fact with it all. When I start to drift off a bit is when people start to gild the lily, you know. Yeah. Well, I was abducted, and then they did this to me, and then the next day, you know, a dog man appeared at me front, and I was thinking, that's great if that's happened to you, and all credit to you, but actually, how unlucky can you be? Yes. You get to have these things happen where you think the genuine account and a normal workaday people that don't want this to happen to them, and the circumstances, which is very often what happens, circumstances just take over at a pace, and they're suddenly faced with this amazing experience. You know, the classic one, I know we mentioned him earlier, Philip Mantle and Calvin Parker, you know, that is such a fantastic account, because these are people that you would not expect would go out their way to report UFOs. There was absolutely no need for them to do it, an abduction, and they've always maintained the same story, and they've never said, oh, and guess what, in 1977 they came and got me again. You know, and you know, they've just made, although I think Calvin Parker was now saying that he had some things that happened when he was a child. But again, that sort of makes sense. You know, it's these tight, matter-of-fact, credible stories are really the ones that interest me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wish you all power on your next project. But in regards to your current book then, Richard, where can people track it down and keep up to date with you? And if they want you to take them on a tour of the local area, hopefully not at night, how can they do so?
So the book is called Lights Upon the Hills. It's available on Amazon, on Kindle and paperback. And I will just say I'm really, really, really pleased with the paperback product. It's something I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to have the colour photos and everything in there. It's twice the size as the one I published in 2019, so there's a lot more information to it. And then, you know, any comments or anything you want to talk about, or if you want to get in touch with me, I'm at richardrokeby@yahoo.com, and just email me and I'll quite happily email you back. So that's it.
Fabulous. Well, listen, thank you again for your time. Thank you for bringing this case back into the light from the shadows where it had been shunted to for several decades. And as I say, been a lovely conversation. Thank you for enlightening us all on these strange events and even more oddness that seems to be occurring in that particular area. And I wish you the best for your future projects. And thank you again for joining me, Richard.
No, thank you, Paul. Really, really enjoyed it. Absolute pleasure to be on your show.